It's a sunny Sunday afternoon at the big park in Raytown. This park is 18 sweeping acres with a playground, a few tennis courts, and a skate park. Shambrisha Roland and her two sons are spending the day here. They came so her five-year-old, Jalen, could watch the skateboarders.
Are the skateboarders cool?
No, I don't know.
No?
I don't know about them.
Oh, okay. He likes them.
There's a diverse crowd at the park today, but Shambrisha says she notices a mostly white community. Having moved from Dallas to Overland Park, then Overland Park to Independence, it's something that catches her attention.
I think about it, yeah. I don't know, sometimes you get the feeling, you know, that you stand out, like, you know, people look at you different, or, you know, people think you talk funny, or your hair, you know.
She and her husband want to move to Grandview. They'd like to live closer to their church, but they'd also feel more at home in a more diverse community. In the meantime, for Independence and Raytown, she has one simple hope.
That people would be okay with living in a neighborhood with different races and, you know, I think it's nice to have, you know, different cultures integrated with each other.
Independence, where Shambrisha and her family live, has a majority white population, but Raytown has actually experienced a significant increase in its African American population over the past decade. Suburbs like Raytown aren't the only places seeing changing demographics. New data shows that white people are moving back to Kansas City, Missouri after decades of white flight. So why do people like Shambrisha still look around and see neighborhoods where everyone looks the same? I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's the big question on KCUR's Central Standard. Later in the show, we'll visit with an MU alum about her memories of race on the Columbia campus. But for now, let's stick with our own metro. I'm joined by Whitney Terrell and Quentin Lucas. Whitney is a writer. His novel, The King of Kings County, tells the story of white flight in Kansas City with a focus on racial real estate covenants that kept new suburban developments looking lily white. Hi, Whitney.
How's it going?
Good. How are you?
I'm great.
I hope you don't mind my letting our listeners know that you happen to be white. It's relevant to the conversation, so.
Yes, I am. I'm still that way on the radio and off.
You grew up in Kansas City. Where did you live as a kid?
I lived like just a few blocks from here, 54th and Oak. In fact, my parents still live there. So, you know, you can come by and trick or treat.
Cool.
You know, next year.
I will. Well, you moved away, then came back again. Did Kansas City look different to you when you returned?
Well, I came back in about 1996, and it was different to me. It actually seemed like very much the same city that I had lived in growing up. But what had happened was that I'd had a really interesting professor in graduate school named James McPherson, who had insisted that it was important for writers of all races to write about race and think about race in America. And so, thanks to his teaching and the reading that I did with him, the city looked different to me, even though the city was the same.
Yeah. What did you see that you hadn't seen before?
Well, I was just aware that I had grown up, you know, just a few blocks from Troost, and that, you know, we had spent our lives as a white family always going west. I knew nothing about the east side of Kansas City, and that the racial divide in Kansas City, which was very strong and had been all through the 80s and into the 90s when I came back, was an important story of Kansas City, and at that time, an undertold story. So that was the city that I found when I moved back here.
So where in the city do you live now, and why do you live there?
I'm really not falling far from the tree. So I live at like 55th and Rock Hill. Before that, I lived at 54th and Virginia. So I spent about 10 years living east of Troost, and then we needed a bigger house, so we moved onto Rock Hill Road.
Well, we'll get back to Whitney's story shortly, but Quentin Lucas is on city council representing the 3rd District at large. The 3rd District is one of the two city districts often referred to as the urban core or sometimes the east side. And he, too, grew up in Kansas City. Quentin, where did you grow up?
Well, I moved around quite a bit from motels on the east side to some time in South Kansas City, apartment 82nd and Troost. If it was south of the river and east of Troost, I've usually touched that neighborhood for a bit.
You kind of straddled multiple worlds as a kid because although you lived in the neighborhoods you've just described, you attended Barstow, a private college prep school in South Kansas City. Can you talk about your experience and perspective as someone who had a window into worlds that are usually, for a lot of people, really separate?
Well, at the time, I think it was just a fun place for me because I was a boy just going to school and enjoying it. I think as I've aged, I realized just how much of a chameleon I was. Really brief story. One day, our car broke down at about 119th and State Line in front of some gigantic houses. And I remember just being mortified that everybody saw my mother's 84 Chevy Nova. This was far after the 80s. That was there. And there was always this kind of attempt to, in some ways, mask issues of poverty, which I think I experienced, but also racial issues. There were folks that were kind for the most part, but who really never really engaged with what was going on in Kansas City broadly.
How would you describe the racial reality of Kansas City during your childhood in the 80s and 90s?
Well, I would say that our Kansas City, Missouri School District desegregation case was at the heart of it. Every day on the news, you would see discussions of what was going on racially, and I think it was...
Remind us of that case.
Sure, sure. Owing to our history of segregation in Kansas City, Missouri, and the segregated schools I know my folks attended and many still attend to this day, we were under federal court order starting in the late 1970s, but particularly in the 80s and 90s, to spend a great deal of money to try to improve the Kansas City School District, and our magnet school program being the real attempt to do so. So trying to get whites attracted back to the Kansas City, Missouri public schools, urban schooling. In some ways, you might see a flaw just in that policy approach in and of itself. But a lot of places, like the private school I attended, or schools that kind of bordered Kansas City all around, saw a tremendous amount of white flight. And I think in many ways what we're seeing now have seen black flight in the years since, when we talk about Raytown or Grandview or a number of areas. And I don't know if it was a time that was a good conversation for Kansas City. It was probably the first time in my life I saw, in my life, I'm a bit younger, but nevertheless, saw white people kind of give up on integrated schools, city, and what have you, and instead saying, well, that's just a mess. If we can create strong enough lines, if we can move just across the state line or move to a different community, we can be away from the problem. And so I saw a lot of people who might have cared, but very few answers that were trying to make the city a better place, in my opinion.
You know, you mentioned that now we're seeing black flight. Can you explain what you think is a motivating factor or motivating factors in quote-unquote black flight?
Sure. You know, there are a few different things. First, there is a fine housing stock in some of these communities. And frankly, I think in a simpler sense, it's purportedly better public schools and better public school opportunities.
Of the same things that motivate white flight.
The exact same things that motivate white people. And then I think sometimes there is this kind of view of one's neighborhood. If you grew up in a neighborhood with struggle, and I experienced this too and have family members who did, you know, you don't want to be around anymore. If you know somebody who got shot down the street, if you know something that has pain from where you lived, getting away from it sometimes is the easiest view, and sometimes it's just moving 20 minutes south.
Like Whitney, you moved away for higher education and then came back to good old KC.
Yeah.
Did you see things differently after living elsewhere?
No. I think the Kansas City that I returned to, and I like it here, and I'm in public office here, don't get me wrong, but we continue to be, even to this day, I think, challenged by lots of the same things. If there's been one thing that has been disappointing, I think, particularly since I joined the city council, is that in a lot of ways, Kansas City, and I think some of our shortcomings in terms of the conversations we want to have, are just as limited as I ever could have imagined when I was in a high school classroom in the year 2000. And the way we talk about our school district, the way we talk about violence, the way we talk about the East Side, I'll just say briefly, when I was growing up, I didn't know it was called the East Side. Maybe I didn't watch the news enough. But
that's a phrase that does seem newish by comparison.
Right, right. It was where I lived. It's where people live. And even when I talk to developers interested in building something or any broad set of people, a lot of people view too much of Kansas City as that part of town and this part of town.
Well, yeah, the East Side is just a nice way of saying right. The black part of town.
Right.
I mean, it's interesting.
Which people used to feel perfectly fine about saying, you know.
Yeah, there's a whole other part of the city that, I mean, there is a place called the West Side, but it's a very small little pocket. It's not like the rest of the city that's not the East Side.
But that carries
the West
kind of
side.
Like a hipster, kind of niche-y, you know, connotation.
Well, right.
I
mean,
the West Side
I guess
does,
I'm
right?
saying
the East
that,
Side has a whole different meaning.
Yeah, we don't call the whole rest of the city the West Side.
Yeah, we could call it, yeah, why don't we call Kansas City, Kansas, and, you know, all of Johnson County the West Side, you know, yeah.
Well, Quentin, how much do you think history has to do with segregation in our city?
A lot. Certainly it has a lot. I mean, I think one thing that people fail to realize is legal segregation is actually a fairly recent enterprise for us. I mean, legally segregated schools, hospitals, everything. That is my mother's generation. But I won't just leave it all to history, though. I mean, I think we continue to live in a city and an environment where we like things to, in a way, be separate. I mean, I talk to people every day, white and black, and I talk to a number of black folks that may see separation of the way we live is just the way it is, and perhaps the way for some that it should be. So I don't think we can just say, well, it's an accident of history and all of that. But I think every year, and I'm glad we have somebody who's a recent Missoula alum here talking later, when we come back from school, a lot of us like to go back to the places we know, the things we know, and to perpetuate the same institutions we knew before. And I don't see a lot of us really trying to either make some great change or to work in more kind of integrated communities.
What do your constituents see? I mean, what do they tell you? And I'm curious whether your perspective differs as a city officer, as a city official, or no?
Sure. A few ways to take that. First, I'll suggest what my constituents think. This isn't everybody, and there's a broad expanse of them. But last night we had a meeting for the 3rd District community, and the Kansas City Royals, in collaboration with the city and the state of Missouri, are building a new urban youth baseball academy. Seems like a beautiful idea, and it is a wonderful one in most ways. That said, almost everyone in the meeting, almost all of whom were black, were asking questions about what does this really mean for us? Is this just an effort to change what is the East Side, black part of town, whatever you want to call it? Or is it something that's actually meant for our community? And this kind of fear in a way, but also reality, which is a lot of the communities in which we live are ones that nobody cared about for a while until it becomes hipster chic or until it becomes cool and interesting and neat. And I think there are a lot of folks that say, wait, why doesn't it matter before that? Why is it when it's just about resources for our kids, our grandkids, us? It's not something important. And then just to answer your other point, and I'll stop talking.
No, please.
Is, you know, you said about perspective. And I don't think there's a different perspective as a city official. There is a different perspective with the way I speak or the places I was educated and all those types of things. And really, it's not so much that I see the world differently. It's how the world sees me in lots of ways. So if I go into a room and mention an Ivy League education or prep school, right, then they say, oh, gosh, he's like us, right? And there's that very different kind of approach to how I think I'm received than, frankly, almost everybody who was in the community meeting yesterday. And lest you not pick up on this, I think that's a huge problem. It's a huge problem with how people think they're represented in our city.
Well, I want to come back to that. Whitney, I'd like to turn to you because back in September, you invited me to moderate a panel discussion at the library exploring whether downtown's revitalization had made us any less segregated. Can you explain why you were asking that question?
Yeah, well, I mean, the premise of my novel, The King of Kings County, was, you know, that the movement into the suburbs, which was in part fostered by the use of racial covenants by important real estate companies in Kansas City, including the Nichols Company, was the thing that had really segregated the city in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And I thought that the emptying out of downtown was symbolic of the loss of sort of public space where people of different races met and on the street, because there's much more of a sort of public walking space, right? And so, you know, I had a scene in that book where my main character drives a golf ball down Grand Street because there's no cars, there's nobody around. Basically, his vision of like building the suburbs has worked out. And I thought, now, you know, in the last decade, we've seen this incredible revitalization downtown. There's many more people living down there, and we're going to talk about the growth of the white population in that area. And I wanted to know what that had done for integration in Kansas City. And I was genuinely curious. I've been working on a book that's set in Iraq, so it's not an issue that I'd been following really closely other than living here during this time. And what was amazing about the panel, you know, we had Gwen Grant was on it and Emile Cleaver was on it, and they were saying, like, look, this is just a resegregation, not an integration, and that the rents downtown are too expensive and that it has been a largely white influx into the nicer areas of downtown.
Well, you know, and I remember you went into the discussion feeling sort of optimistic. And during the conversation, when some of these really strong cases that perhaps, no, this isn't resulting in the sort of mix of people that you had hoped to see, you expressed that you were incredibly disappointed.
Yeah, I was disappointed. It's very disappointing. I'd like thought, okay, this is going to fix it. It's finally happening. And now you're like, oh, not really.
A lot of the conversation centered around the role of subsidies for downtown real estate and drawing only a certain kind of person to these revitalized areas. Let's hear Gwen Grant of the Urban League with her take on this.
So we've invested all of this money to create yet another predominantly white neighborhood west of Troost. And the sad thing about it is that people who look like me, and I'm middle class African American, these places have been subsidized, but I cannot afford to live there. So we put all this public money so that upper middle class level people who are, you know, in this community are primarily white people, can live downtown with a few millennials who don't care about maybe living in the smaller spaces. I'm not trying to put down millennials, but you know, they're happy to do those things you said, you know, like bop around downtown and enjoy the arts and those kinds of things. But those people who want to make that investment, you know, in housing and who want to be urban dwellers. It's not necessarily easy for African Americans and other minorities to access what our taxpaying dollars have built down here.
That was Gwen Grant. Now here's the library's Crosby Kemper fleshing out a similar point, but with some comparison to other cities that are rehabbing their downtowns in a way that encourages maybe more diversity.
One of the things that happens, Whitney, is if you subsidize it, you raise the price of it.
Right.
And we've raised the price of residential real estate downtown. So you're right. You've said this. Gwen said this. Residential real estate downtown is very high rental per square foot. So what you end up with is an unnatural gentrification. If we had different policies, if we weren't subsidizing residential real estate so much, but we had but otherwise we're friendly to developers, we'd have a little bit cheaper real estate development.
What
downtown.
Does otherwise friendly to developers mean?
Low regulation. So
Line
you don't.
Of beer.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is some of it is about, you know, bars and restaurants are a big part of downtown restoration around the country. So you have to be friendly to them. Kansas City's got a lot of regulations around that, by the way, and you have to have low taxes on small businesses. You have to have low regulation, not low regulation. You have to have intelligent regulation of small business. You have to be encouraging to it. And that happens in other places around the country where it's not all tax incentivized, and it ends up being more integrated than Kansas City is at this point.
So Quentin Lucas, I'm curious. You Whitney and I were both there, but what do you think of what you're hearing from Gwen Grant and Crosby Kemper? Do you think the city's approach to subsidizing new developments downtown perpetuates segregation in our era? Maybe. In a comparable way to real estate covenants in the past?
Boy, that is a fascinating question. I certainly see negatives to our current subsidizing policy and incentive approach. Does it resegregate in the same way? I think in some way, informally, we support segregation. I don't know if we're the active party necessarily in doing it. I don't think we're quite the J.C. Nichols company that actually has the covenants themselves. But in many ways, I think it is important for us to realize that we are in a way a partner in some way to what is going on and what continues to happen. So when I talk to people about the future of downtown Kansas City and residents in downtown Kansas City, I don't know, to Ms. Grant's point, I don't know if they're actually talking about attracting black folks from other parts of our community. And then, frankly, one of the most interesting things, I think when we talk politics and we talk this last election in the city, everybody talks about millennials all the time as if millennials.
They sure do.
Right. Millennials are this bizarre group that don't really seem to exist in Kansas City right now, but they do. Every day in my neighborhood, there are lots of young black men and women that are looking for opportunities, looking for jobs, looking for places to live. And I said this in one forum. I'm not sure our conversation, we're talking about attracting new tech people or attracting new this, that, or the other. They're really talking about having jobs for the black people that are here now. And other types of folks. So I do think an important part of the conversation that we don't have downtown and incentives is actually how do we have a center of our city that's trying to attract all people who are actually already in our city.
And speaking of people who are already in our city, I mean, Gwen Grant also made the point that we didn't hear this in the clip, but that the so-called urban core is spreading beyond the 3rd and 5th districts into the 6th district. Yeah. And she argues that that is part of why white people are taking more of an interest in living downtown. Do you think we maybe are seeing that it's the same old thing, white people fleeing neighborhoods where black people are moving in?
You know, I think they're separate. I certainly think that you continue to see flight follow these patterns. But I would think that a lot of the folks we're seeing move downtown, it is actually connected to a new approach to urbanization and wanting to actually live in walkable spaces. So I think we're seeing a different kind of focus of society from what we probably had 50 years ago. Who am I to talk? But it's just what I've read. And so I don't know if they're moving downtown to flee black people as much as they're moving downtown because in many ways, yeah, it wasn't emptying out. And now there are these wonderful spaces that permit walkability, accessibility, all the things that are great about being in the city's core. But I will say that I think in the Southlands, the 6th District and other far-flung parts of the city, you do see communities change fairly quickly from a South Kansas City that was not predominantly black to one where if you go to some of the public schools, you certainly have a very different looking population there now.
I want to bring Frank Lank into this discussion. He's with us from the Mid-America Regional Council, or Mark, if you're on a first name basis, which most of Kansas City is. Frank, good morning.
Good morning.
Do you have any data on the movement we're talking about, on where in the city people are moving and whether we're mixing it up or just playing sort of a racial musical chairs?
So, at least to a certain extent, we are mixing it up. If you look at something called the Index of Dissimilarity, which looks at if everyone was spread completely equally, you know, how many people would we have to move in order to get to that ideal state, if that was an ideal state? And, you know, a decade ago, it was 70%. Today, it's like 60%. So it's still a lot of people that would have to move to make things perfectly equal. But we are making progress. And you see it in the growing diversity in the suburbs. And so in Johnson County, north of the river, blacks are also actually the fastest growing minority north of the river in Kansas City, Missouri. Whereas elsewhere it would be Hispanics primarily. So you see a growing diversity throughout the region. Your question about whether we are, you know, as minorities move out, do whites move out farther? To a certain extent, that's also true. We see a tremendous amount of growth in white populations on the fringes of our metropolitan area, in large part because it's more expensive and minorities can't afford to live there.
Where in the greater metropolitan area are you seeing the most significant shifts in demographics?
Well, I will draw attention to downtown. I mean, I've looked at the data. We have maps of data going back to 1920 looking at population change. And, you know, in the core of the city, it has been nothing but population loss for 70 years. And then in the last decade, we see growth around downtown. So that's a positive trend in my estimation. Now, it is largely white. It is largely west of Troost. But we're just in the beginning stages. So the question in my mind is whether that is a seed that can broaden. Because there's no question that we have a difficult time throughout the region building affordable housing. We need more affordable housing where the job opportunities are. And that's a challenge for us throughout the region.
So, you know, you talked about that this could be the seed for more change and maybe more substantive change. What would make it go one way or the other? Are there predictors? Are there things that could encourage more mixing, more changing? I mean, is there another city and other examples we could look to?
So I think this problem of gentrification exists wherever there's been urban redevelopment. I think that's true. The best cities make a concerted effort and have the capacity to develop affordable housing alongside market rate housing, and they very intentionally try and build them side by side and more integrated, and not so much all the affordable housing is over here and all the market rate housing is over there. That just creates that disparity that perpetuates the history that we've had.
So intentionality.
So intentionality and consciously trying to spread it around.
When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll bring someone new to Kansas City in on the discussion. As downtown becomes desirable again and the suburbs are attracting more minority residents, are we mixing it up or playing musical chairs? You can chime in at 816-235-2888. Just a little time left, so don't put it off. I'm Gina Kaufman, back in a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman. Welcome back to Central Standard on KCUR. We often scrutinize our city, and rightly so, for its entrenched patterns of segregation, historic patterns that people want to break out of but just can't seem to shake. And new data about white people moving back to the city as black people head to the suburbs brings to mind that old phrase. At least it kind of does for me. The more things change, the more they stay the same. But is that your experience? Call 816-235-2888 to join the conversation or tweet us at KCURCST. I'd like to turn now to Kristen Jeffers. She's new to Kansas City, and she blogs as The Black Urbanist. That's also the title of her book. Hi, Kristen.
Hi.
So tell me about The Black Urbanist. Explain that name.
Well, urbanism is a school in sort of architecture and planning that talks about returning to the city. There's the new urbanism started by Andreas Duaney and five other folks, and it's the movement has become the Congress for New Urbanism. And essentially, it's talking about, you know, walkability, having services within walking distance, you know, everything from your grocery store to things like civic needs, having adequate transit, if you can walk, if you can bike, having those things available to you. And also, there's a piece of the charter that talks about diversity. And as I was starting to write, I've always loved living in a city. I'm originally from Greensboro, North Carolina. Obviously, Greensboro has its own history and has its own divides of its own. And I really wanted to diversify the conversation, even though there are African-American planners, architects, people who have been speaking out, you know, in their various communities about, you know, strengthening neighborhoods. I didn't see a lot of women involved. I didn't see a lot of young women. And I definitely didn't see that in the growing blogosphere that was happening around, you know, streets, you know, things like Streets Blog. There's another site, Greater Washington. And I wanted to let people know that I'm here and I have a voice and I have a perspective and we need to hear that. And we're not just women aren't just people who are raising kids. You know, black folks aren't people who are just poor or not writing. And even the folks who are our professionals, we are speaking out. We do have a voice in this conversation. So that was 5 years ago, and here we are today.
When and why did you move to Kansas City?
Well, I was through the Streets Blog Network, I met the two Erics, Eric Bunch and Eric Rogers at Bike Walk KC, and fast forward
to Eric's.
Yes. Fast forward to then needing a communications person, and you went through the process of, you know, interviewing and everything. And then, you know, in June of this year, I made the move across the country. I literally drove my car with my mom and my aunt and my cousin, and I ended up in Midtown because our offices are in Midtown, and I wanted to live close enough to the office so I could get to and from easily because I believe strongly in the principle of walkability and urbanism. And, you know, that's been the last few months for me.
What do you think walkability and urbanism have to do with race and diversity? Do you think those two things are related?
Absolutely. My dad taught me how to ride a bike when I was young, and we lived in a working class area of Greensboro. Of course, my father's passed away now, but, you know, before then, in my childhood, through my teens and 20s, you know, he often used walking as a way to help, you know, blow off steam. You know, there were times where he didn't have transportation of his own, so he used he walked.
Yeah, and 2 feet.
2 feet. Just simple. He would walk from our home. Our downtown Greensboro was about a mile. It sort of reminds me of walking from my home in Midtown to, say, Union Station, much like I did for the Royal Celebration a week ago. And just, you know, that and just getting around and the fact that he had to. And the fact that he did, and he did it anyway, granted, with the walkability movement, you know, we're asking for what we call complete streets. We're asking for bike lanes. We're asking for better sidewalks. And we need those things. You know, we need the dignity back in walking and biking. But, you know, I was always just thinking, well, my dad did it anyway. And he risked his life in some cases because he was walking down, in some cases, 4-lane, 5-lane roads on the shoulder.
But can you explain what that has to do with race?
I feel like a lot of people who are poor and poor, poverty and race are connected in this country, especially in a city like Kansas City, where people were restricted from not only just where they lived, but the job type of jobs they could have and the types of things they could do. And so you have a lot more people who don't have the option to buy a car. You know, you have a lot of people who don't have the income. And so because that's so tied to race, and even though there are people who have been able to move up and move out, like myself, like Quentin, there are still people who are stuck, and they feel stuck, and they feel like oftentimes...
Sometimes physically stuck.
Physically stuck, and then there are still people that feel like they don't deserve things. You know, they see all these different racial incidents. You know, obviously what's been happening at Mizzou and all across the nation, especially in the last few years, you know, just proof that African-Americans, Latinos, there's just certain things that we just can't have. And so maybe for people that's a decent car or decent transit service or a sidewalk that actually isn't cracked, or, you know, if you're riding your bike, you can ride your bike in your own protected lane. You know, granted, these are things that young white millennials and even older white folks are talking about now, but African-Americans and Latinos and other people of color, other people in poverty have had to sort of live through that.
You know, I wonder what's been your larger experience with how race shapes behavior in Kansas City, or maybe the other way around.
I have been disappointed in the fact, just like Quentin mentioned, there are people who seem to just stick to themselves no matter who they are. You know, it wasn't like we were doing a lot of integration in Greensboro, we were doing more. You know, I would go to my first Friday and I would see people I knew and would be very diverse. Now here I've been in Westport, I've gone to different concerts, you know, I've gone to meetings on the South Plaza, I've gone to the Plaza, and I've seen more diversity there. But as far as just social, as far as, you know, 11 o'clock or 10:30, whatever, on Sunday morning, I haven't seen it. You know, I'm the only African-American that works at my office, and not that that's, you know, been a trouble or a barrier, but I feel like that's other people's experiences, even in bigger companies. And, you know, you go to First Friday and I didn't see a lot of diversity there. If it's true what Quentin has said, I mean, I thought I was just imagining things, but clearly it's been something that's going on. And I would think that with a city the size of Kansas City, the city that's been known and is nationally known, there are songs have been written about this city. This is a railroad town.
We just won the World Series.
Yes, people are the world is looking at Kansas City right now, and has been at various times over the years. You know, the jazz era, the Negro Leagues era. I just hope that there was more connectivity. And obviously, I'm still new and I'm still learning the networks, but I have struggled to connect in a more organic way, especially being a person who would like to be more, would like to go places on foot, would like to be able to use the transit system at when I need it to get where I need to go and not have to drive. So,
let's hear from some of our callers on this stuff. When you call 816-235-2888, you'll be talking to Kristen Jeffers, the Black urbanist who we've just been hearing about. You'll also be talking with Frank Lank from the Mid-America Regional Council, Quentin Lucas, city council member, and Whitney Terrell, author of The King of Kings County. Let's hear from Walter in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Walter.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to make a couple of quick comments. All things are not equal, and in today's culture, we talk about ideas like opposing ideas have equal validity irregardless of the context or the facts. So when it comes to blacks moving to the suburbs in Kansas City, this is not the same as white flight in the 50s when blacks were moving south of 27th Street and whites were moving out. You know, they had covenants and they had all kind of real estate policies, and whites were scared to death and they didn't want to be around, so they left. They're coming back into the central city, not just downtown, but in 64128, 64129, 64130. I see them on the bus stops, and I see whites very comfortable living among blacks. And the blacks that are moving out of the city, a lot of them are young women with children. They're given vouchers now. I doubt that they were given vouchers in the 60s and the 70s. Or the 80s for subsidized housing and lease some in other communities, but that's taking place now. One other thing interesting, I was at a meeting a couple of months ago, a community meeting, a small group of people, somebody from the Kansas City Star newspaper happened to be there, And one thing that was said, I don't know how it slipped out, and I think it kind of slipped out, they said when schools close in neighborhoods, they depopulate those areas. So with all the school closings, people have to have somewhere to go to school. And that's pressure on families and women with children to relocate to different parts of the city. So blacks are moving out. There's some stuff behind it. There's some incentive, and whites are moving back in. And I think it needs to be looked at a little closer. I think, and one final thing, with the football players in MU did what they did, I thought about professional sports, period. And maybe it would be good to do a study of people on professional sports teams, or sports teams, period, because usually they're black and there's white, and there may be other groups. And I wonder how the attitudes of whites or men particularly that find themselves in social and business and professional settings where they have to be in a cooperative spirit and unity with other members of the team. I wonder how that affects them compared to larger white society over time.
Man, that is... Okay, so Walter has given us just a huge amount to talk about. Really interesting points he has to make. I want to start with this point about some of the demographic observations and what Walter sees as the driving forces behind those, both historically when we're talking about white flight and more recently when we're talking about black movement to the suburbs. Frank Link and Quentin Lucas, I think maybe you guys are in the best position to talk about those. I'll start with you, Quentin.
Yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, I agree with Walter on the point that restrictive covenants of a few decades ago are largely different than why black people are moving to a good school opportunity or anything like that now, and I think that's significant. I think the other thing that I found moving with what he had to say was that incentives do play a role. Now, we talked about incentives as it relates to building apartments and other things, neat, cool things downtown, but also our housing policy in Kansas City has largely tried to, in a way, center affordable housing in certain areas and move affordable housing through certain areas. And we've played a large part in making poorer areas continue to be poor. And there's a question there. Do you want people to be able to live where they do now but make it affordable, or do you want to spread it throughout the entire city, and how politically unpopular might that be? So I think we certainly do play a part as political stakeholders, both on the local level, but certainly state and federal as well.
Frank Link, what are your, I mean, do you have data? Do you have information on some of this stuff?
So I guess the first thing I want to make sure everyone is clear on is that, you know, in Kansas City, Missouri, south of the river and in Jackson County, whites are still moving out. I mean, the net is still a loss, a 15% loss over the last decade or so. It's just in a very small area where whites are moving back in, and you can actually see it and measure it. And I do think that people move out from areas that are impoverished, where the infrastructure is not good, where the crime is high, and where the schools are poor. And that's true for everyone. And so when you create an area in the center of the city that has those conditions, everyone who can afford to wants to move away from those, and they do when they can. And so the question for the metro then is that we end up having to recreate new infrastructure, and it becomes unaffordable. And you know, it happens in Kansas City, Missouri proper. It happens everywhere, but it is a very expensive way to develop a city.
Well, we're going to get right back to this discussion. Our guest from MU had a scheduling conflict and won't be joining us, so we're going to continue this awesome conversation when we return to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman. You're listening to Central Standard, and our guests this morning are Frank Link of the Mid-America Regional Council, Kristen Jeffers, who blogs as the Black Urbanist, Quentin Lucas, a city council member representing the 3rd District at large, and Whitney Terrell, author of The King of Kings County. We have a full studio, a full switchboard, and a really interesting topic. We're discussing the ongoing problem of segregated behavior and living patterns in Kansas City, even as we see the kinds of movement that we would think might change that. We're just talking about, with a previous caller, some of the differences between what today is inspiring people to move and some of the history behind that. I'd like to talk now with Janet in Kansas City North. Hi, Janet. Janet?
Have continued huge problem with the redevelopment of a lot of the inner core, where there have been some improvements and some little bits, you know, of rehabilitated, but there's still so many practically unusable housing, you know, in the main part of town, with continued loss of tax revenues, et cetera, and too many people kind of forced, because there is not enough affordable income housing in the newer developments, that they continue to have to live in substandard and crumbling housing and so on. And I do definitely agree that along with in the new development areas, and especially downtown, there's not hardly any affordable housing. And, you know, I'm always very disappointed when I see, okay, this new place is going, you know, and it's downtown or it's near downtown or whatever. Great, but it's always high-priced stuff.
Janet, you know what? We have got a developer who's also called in, and I'm curious whether he has some comments that might shed light on that very thing. Butch from the Countryside neighborhood, welcome to the show.
Thank you for taking my call. And, you know, as far as the affordable housing goes, you know, yes, I think that, and I actually developed more commercial real estate and wanted to talk about Troost Avenue, but, you know, I have found that, you know, a lot of times what we're doing is getting some affordable housing, maybe two houses in an otherwise, you know, pretty well-established neighborhood, and I think that the most of the housing experts find that to be a much more effective way to not only bring some affordable housing to otherwise, you know, somewhat expensive neighborhoods, but also find a way not to over-concentrate affordable housing into one single area. I think that, you know, what I was going to talk about, of course, was Troost Avenue.
Go ahead and talk about it.
Okay, well, you know, Troost Avenue is really the 800-pound gorilla in the room when it comes to, you know, racial and economic segregation in our town, still to this very day. And there are a group of us who have developed, and I'm one of the people who have developed down in the crossroads. I'm developing along 63rd Street between Oak and Troost right now. But there are a group of us that feel that the redevelopment of Troost is imperative, and it doesn't just mean bring in gentrification and bring in, you know, businesses like the Crossroads to Troost. What it means is to do a combination of bringing in development and getting people from Brookside to shop Troost, but also to bring stability to some of the small businesses that have been on Troost for a number of years, because Troost needs to be a meeting place. It needs to be a place where people who live on the Prospect Corridor can come and shop, and it means to be a place where people who live in Brookside feel like they can come and shop.
Butch, I'm gonna let some people respond to this. I see Quentin Lucas nodding.
Yeah, I mean, I agree completely. Whitney during the break was actually talking about how we can have spaces that are good meeting places for people of all colors and types to actually be somewhere. Part of that's fueled by public transit, but another part of that is fueled by actually having, let's say, a developed Troost, where you have people that are actually shopping somewhere side by side, but coming from perhaps different areas. So much of the Kansas City story is very different things. I'll just say briefly, I didn't know that there was a Brookside St. Patrick's Day parade until last year when I was a campaign. My entire life growing up, missed it. Why? Because that just wasn't my part of town. The more opportunities we have to actually have people together and actually doing things every day, making the shopping part of it, making coffee shops or restaurants, what have you, part of it, and making those in spots that aren't just black people going to another part of the city, I think is vital.
Maybe there should be a parade that goes across Troost,
that's right,
instead of one that's either on either side. And the other thing is the idea of making Troost a meeting place rather than a dividing line is like that's sort of like the holy grail of racial politics in Kansas City. I mean, if that could be done, that would be amazing.
Well, please. And then also just not being okay with getting out of your comfort zone. One, you know, I think when we talk about integration, we talk about the melting pot. I'd like us to think of ourselves as being in a salad bowl and realizing that we're all very different. But in a salad, you can work together and you can be awesome. So I feel like in Kansas City, when we build these areas, if we built up Troost, or even as we're coming on the plaza, you know, trusting people to come on the plaza and not look at a certain way at when folks come on the plaza that we may not expect to be there. Same with downtown, same with First Fridays at Crossroads. You know, that's a thing that should go on nationwide. We should think about that. And I say that to my folks back home, too. But just be yourself. Don't be afraid of who you see and just, you know, push together.
This is already starting to happen organically, so I want to just go with it. I'd like to spend just a moment before we go. You know, clearly this is bigger than any one person or one policy can change, but if it's even just a drop in the bucket, I'd like to hear one small thing that each of you think could push our city in the teensiest bit of a more integrated direction. We don't have very much time, so just your short answer to that very complicated question.
Let's ramp up what we're doing with public transit. Let's get our headways better. Let's get more buses. And, you know, the streetcar is a big strength, but let's do more with that type of stuff. And then again, the protected bike lanes, the complete streets, the better sidewalks, the things where we're working at on doing at Bike Walk. Let's keep doing that.
Quentin Lucas?
I say very simply, I love Troost Prospect Main discussions. Let's invest more in infrastructure and transit that's east-west, 18th Street, 31st Street, 39th, 47th, east-west, so we're not actually just talking about lines all the time.
Okay, so the idea of focusing on a more globally rather than on a specific street?
Right, I'll be very focused, right? We're actually talking often about how do we streetcars down Main, right, or max down Troost or anything else of the sort, or max down Prospect. Why is it that we don't actually talk about streets like 39th mm-hmm. that actually go from the state line far east, right, and have development plans that actually target all of it? That's how you're actually hitting a population that's fairly diverse the whole way through. 39th is a great example.
So, yeah, Whitney Terrell, author of The King of Kings County, what's your thought about just one thing that you think could push things in a positive direction?
Well, I think that I teach at UMKC. I'm part of the creative writing program in the English department there. And I think that despite the stories we've been hearing about MU this week, UMKC has a tremendously progressive chancellor. And it's a university that's committed to diversity and inclusion, and it sits at a very strategic place. So not only is it physically important to the integration in the city, the people who are at that university teach those things. And I think teaching and the stories and history are extremely important to this. And you have to just keep reteaching people. You have to keep learning that message over time.
So education.
Yeah.
Frank Lenk of the Mid-America Regional Council.
So I'm going to give you two. Sorry. One is, only one-third of the growth is white, non-Hispanic. Two-thirds of our population growth is minority growth. And so whether we want to or not, we're going to become more diverse. And the second is, the best cities find a way to incentivize affordable housing throughout their city by making growth work for them. So as developers come and say to build this, you know, we need these incentives, and the city pushes back and says, yes, okay, but build some affordable housing along with that. And so if we could make that happen throughout the metro, we won't get these pockets of poverty that are so entrenched and reproduced so much over time.
We have time for one last thought from a caller. It will have to be pretty quick. But Peter in Kansas City, Missouri, what can you share with us?
Hello.
Hi, Peter.
Hi. I just had a quick comment. You know, the suburbanization of the American city, and this Kansas City has done this big time, has occurred since World War II. What I'm a little concerned about as the inner city starts to repopulate, and I don't know if it's a trend yet or not, but if it does become a trend, I'm a little concerned that we may end up creating some undesirable areas in the suburbs that don't have any transportation. And by undesirable, I mean areas where there's vacant housing and where people don't necessarily want to move into. And those areas don't have any transportation infrastructure the way Kansas City does. I was talking with one of your colleagues while I was on hold, and he said Paris is an example of a city where the suburbs are the ghettos and the inner city is the
is
the more high-income areas.
It is. Europe follows a different development pattern than the United States. But Frank Blank, maybe you can take this one.
So, I mean, there's been some concern that all the big homes that we built for baby boomers, and then their kids are all gone. What are we going to do with all them? Who's going to buy those homes? And so there is a potential for, you know, some distress even in suburban areas, but they're generally wealthy and they have resources to help deal with that as well.
Such a complex, big issue. I mean, the history of segregation alone is a big issue, and the present and future Of segregation and integration? Yes. We could have gone on for hours, but our time is up. Frank Lenk of the Mid-America Regional Council, thank you.
Thank you.
Kristen Jeffers of the blog The Black Urbanist, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Quentin Lucas, 3rd District at Large City Council member, it's been great talking to you.
Thank you.
And Whitney Terrell, author of The Huntsman, but also The King of Kings County, thanks for inspiring a conversation about this before all this data was even coming out.
Thanks for having us all here.
You can listen back to this conversation later today at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, tune in for a conversation with veterans about the healing power of art and their feelings about being thanked for their service. That Veterans Day conversation tomorrow at 10. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. Special thanks to Andrea Tudhope. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't miss Up to Date next. We'll